Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United tonight. Tonight we're going to cover some more new premieres at the New York Film Festival, and we're going to speak to author John Gilvey. He has a new book out, a biography on a great character actor by the name of Jerry Orbach. Jerry Orbach. What's the first thing that comes to mind when I say Jerry Orbach, Jerry?
Law and Order.
That's what I thought.
I mean, there are other movies. Obviously, there are movies and everything, but Law and Order is the first thing that comes to mind.
Yeah. Well, he's also in my favorite Woody Allen movie.
Crimes and Misdemeanors.
That's right. That's right. Classic.
It is
so
an awesome movie.
So we're going to talk about his career in a little bit. But let's, right here at the top of the show, let's get Dean on the line. He's been covering, I believe, the 49th annual New York Film Festival for us. I know it's the New York Film Festival.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
Part that the part that I believe is the 49th year part. Dean.
Hey, how are you?
Hey.
Well, I'm down here on the streets of New York. I thought I'd come down to, rather than be up in the apartment that I'm staying at, I thought I'd come down the streets to get a little street scene kind of background.
That'll be good.
The times when I was calling in, a couple of years ago.
If I don't hear ambulances and fire engines and police cars, I'm going to feel cheated.
Can I ask a question of what you've seen?
Well, sure.
Have you seen Melancholia?
I have not seen Melancholia, and I have to tell you, I think I've missed it. So I have to.
Okay,
I
watched
tell
it
you
last
that.
Night.
Okay, so what's your take on it?
I think it's interesting that we live in a period where the two most pretentious movies of the year have come out in the same, in 2011, you have two of the most pretentious movies come out. Terrence Malick's Tree of Life and Lars von Trier's Melancholia. I like both films a lot. I'm tempted to say Melancholia is my favorite film of the year.
No.
It's not, because you have to take that with a grain of salt. But it's so fucked up. It is like the secular version of Tree of Life. But if Tree of Life is this pretentious movie about the beginning of the world, kind of, then Melancholia is this like secular end of the world Armageddon film, and it's so messed up, but it's also, there's a part of it that's so brilliant, and Kirsten Dunst, the award that she won at Cannes, yeah, she deserved that. I mean, I would have given it to her for The Virgin Suicides. Hell, I would have given it to her for Dick, for that matter. But it's, her performance is nothing short of awesome. And as everyone knows, I've loved Kirsten Dunst since the moment that she walked on screen for Drop Dead Gorgeous. But it's just incredible.
So you don't think that the Smurfs is the second most pretentious movie of the year?
I think the Smurfs is the Avatar for children movie. Yeah. I think those are the two. It's really interesting. You have these two films that deal, the Malick film, which is essentially about the creation. And the Malick film is more accessible, if that's even possible. Lars's film is so wrapped up. He is so wrapped up in himself, and he's always has been. But in this film, I think I like this better than Antichrist. I know a lot of people like Antichrist. I could not get into it. I really tried very hard to get into Antichrist, and I couldn't.
Antichrist falls apart for me like after the first 40 minutes or so. Like
it took you that long?
Into the woods.
You, it fell apart for me after 10 minutes. But okay.
Is this is this one shot like a Calvin Klein commercial, like Antichrist?
No. This is actually a very beautifully, I mean, really beautifully shot movie, in a sense. But there is something. My brother brought this up today. We were talking about it. I know I'm breaking the waves, and even in Dancer in the Dark, you get the feeling that the outside world manages to seep in. In this film, in Antichrist, and I would even, you know, in some others, the outside world never seeps in. But in this film especially, with the exception of when Charlotte Gainsbourg goes on the internet to look for something up, there is no presence of the outside world whatsoever. It's a very closed-off...
Insulated. Yeah,
insulated version. And it's just fascinating. I mean, it's not for everyone, but, I mean, those people who walked out of Tree of Life, they would have probably walked out within the first 10 minutes of this film.
Is that available on demand now?
Yes. That's the only way I could have watched it is on demand.
Okay.
Yeah, I noticed it was on demand last night, so I almost watched it, but the person I was staying with said, I won't pay for it.
No, it's not for everybody. I mean, it is a very. I mean, there are people who will. I think Dean will know this. You know, like with Dr. Zhivago and Lawrence of Arabia, you have an overture before you start the film, or Spartacus. You know, 5-10 minutes of the. Well,
he did the same thing with Dancer in the Dark too.
Yeah, he did. That's right. And he does it here. And I mean, it's like I think it goes on for 10 minutes. And I know there are people who will probably like pay for this or, what is this? Why is this going on? Yeah, but it's interesting because within that, there are scenes that you see in the trailer that are in that part that don't show up in the rest of the movie. So it's interesting, but it's just a fascinating film. I think it's his, I want to say it's his most accomplished film since Dancer in the Dark.
Hmm. I really believe that for sure.
I mean, because Dogville and Manderley, no.
those are acquired taste for sure.
Yeah.
All right, well, we can talk a little bit later because I finally saw Tree of Life. I hadn't seen that movie.
Oh, good. Okay, cool.
Well,
so,
I won't stay around for that. But
New York Film Festival. Did you see My Week with Marilyn earlier today?
I did, but I'm not going to start off with that. I have a plan here, so I'm going to start off with some other. I'm going to lead up to my Week with Marilyn, which was the premiere showing of it, even before the premiere public showing of it tonight, which it should be going on in about 30 minutes. I'm going to start off with some of the lesser titles first and then work my way up to the ones ones that people are highly anticipating.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually going to start off with Wim Wenders' new movie, and I'm going to start my review right now.
Okay.
Shot in a bright, vibrant 3D. It's the best use of the process I've ever witnessed. Wim Wenders' tribute to the work of German choreographer Pina Bausch is suitably called Pina and his Hoot. Wenders and Bausch collaborated on this piece before her recent death, and it's perhaps the greatest film about dance ever made. It's only not only a documentary in the strictest sense, as there are talking heads in it. The closest we come to this documentary trope are regal portraits of the dancers in Bausch's Taos Theater of Wuppertal, backed with heartfelt remembrances of their mentor. Most of the film, however, is built around spirited recreations of Bausch's athletic and often surprisingly funny dance works, staged in defocused locales that take maximum advantage of the 3D process. The film isn't always stage-bound, and this allows us to see the dancers perform in parks and on the sides of highways, and most memorably on one dancer on a strikingly red-accented escalator. With its unconventional costuming, bright lighting, and palpable depth of feeling, Pina will make even the most skeptical viewer a lover of modern dance, just as Wenders' film Buena Vista Social Club did for audiences unfamiliar with Cuban music. So it was really great. You know, we had to sit and wait for the Walter Reed Theater for about 15 minutes in line to get the 3D just right. But I've never seen 3D in this way before. It was just so it was so 3D, and the brightness of the screen was just perfect. I mean, there was no loss of, you know, when you're watching 3D movies, sometimes you put on those glasses and you lose a little bit of light. Well, that's the problem. That's a problem with the projectionists, not with a problem with the films themselves or even the process itself. It's a problem with the projectionists who need to put on 3D movies need to be schooled a little bit more in the tweaking their projectors in order to provide us with the maximum effect of the process. So but this was just so much fun. I mean, I went into it kind of like, it's going to be a dance film. I don't know. But I was totally transported by it, and it was a lot of fun. I was surprised how much I was laughing through it because the dances are quite funny sometimes. And
do you think that the subject itself, that dance, lends itself to 3D well?
Oh, yes, for sure. I mean, you know, the whole movie is about movement and placement and placement in the frame. And they're using the focus very well. And since they go to very inventive locales, you're not just stuck on a stage the whole time, you know, or whatever. You really get a sense of place. And the costuming is not just a whole bunch of people in tutus or whatever. You got people men dancing in three piece suits and stuff, and all sorts of
that should be the tagline on the poster. It's not just a bunch of men in tutus. You know what? I say that though because actually, and people think it's a joke, but if you can look it up and you can find reviews that say that Step Up 3D was the best use of 3D up to that point. And it was because of the dance, because the nature of dance lends itself to that format better
right.
than most.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
This is better than
Step Up 3D.
Very surprised by it. Yes, definitely see it in 3D, for sure.
Okay,
my next movie is 444, Last Day on Earth.
Is this Abel Ferrara?
Though the ominous title of Abel Ferrara's newest film is partially self-explanatory, it's really a film about living fully in the present. Willem Dafoe and Shannon Lee play a May-December couple ensconced in their Lower East Side New York apartment, making love, meditating, being creative, and talking to other loved ones via Skype, and watching TV, the TV coverage, as they await the long-predicted burning off of the ozone layer, which will ensure the death of all living things. While a slow background rumble grows bigger on the soundtrack, this sweet, romantic, though often overbaked movie does something that no other apocalyptic film has ever done. It forgoes portrayal of humanity's cries and final teeth gnashings in favor of showing how we'd all likely forget about the value of money or the separations between us all in the face of impending doom. It takes the end of our relationship with the earth to do it, but Ferrara's happiest film portrays the raising of consciousness, the promotion of generosity, and the inspiration of understanding. This is what I like best about 444 Last Days on Earth. It's an undeniably flawed movie, but I like this part of it just the same. Shot sharply on the red-eye camera, which when projected digitally provides its own sort of pinpoint 3D quality, 444 Last Day on Earth may go overboard at times, but it has heart to spare. The things I disliked about it was it's sort of occasionally improv-y kind of overacting. But the things I liked about it the thing I liked about it most, I think I said pretty clearly here, was just its inventive take on things, in this year filled with apocalyptic movies. I mean, this must be the fifth or sixth apocalyptic movie that's come out this year. This is probably one of the more inventive ones, although I wouldn't say it's necessarily the best one. You know,
right.
it's, it's probably a minor Ferrara in the long run, but it's a rare Ferrara movie that you can say, well, it actually portrays kind of an upside to humanity in some ways, even though it's the last day on Earth.
Is there plans for distribution for this? Because he said, you know, there's like Go-Go Tales and Mary have yet to be released. I mean, he says you can torrent these, you know. But are there plans for distribution for this one? Or?
In the press conference, or really, I saw this at a public screening. So at the talk afterwards with Willem Dafoe, Shannon Lee, mm-hmm. Abel Ferrara, and Abel Ferrara's editor, and it's a pretty well edited movie, by the way.
Right.
He said that it was planned for a Valentine's Day release, which is actually kind of perfect because it is a very romantic movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a movie about a relationship, really, and how this last day of this relationship goes. You know?
Just the idea of Abel Ferrara directing a Valentine's Day movie just cracks me up.
Well, no, I mean, yeah, I mean, but I mean,
from the director of Bad Lieutenant.
Well, Bad Lieutenant, but also of The Addiction. But he had some movies like, I mean, New Rose Hotel, and then there's the Blackout. I never saw Our Christmas, which was the last, I think, theatrical movie that he released. Because I mean, the other one, there are several others that haven't seen the light of day as far as like distribution in this country. I'd be very curious to see this. He's fascinating. I read a great biography on him a long time ago, and he's just a fascinating director.
He is. He's the only director. I decided I'm going to make it, you know, as many years as I can come up to do this. I'm going to make it my goal to shake hands with at least one director and have like a little bit of a conversation with them, just a little bit of one.
Mm-hmm.
He's the director that I picked this time because I find him to be so humorous and easy to approach. You know,
right.
I've seen him talk in other press conferences at Cannes and so forth, and I just find him very, very funny and real. I decided to go up and say hello and tell him how much I like this stuff. So, the next film is one I saw last Sunday, also at a public screening, and it's called We Can't Go Home Again. Don't be fooled. Nicholas Ray's final directorial effort, 1976's We Can't Go Home Again, which has recently been restored, is not really a Nicholas Ray film. Yes, he's in it playing himself, and he spent his emeritus years trying to make sense of it in the editing room. But the film, largely shot and performed by students of his at Syracuse's Binghamton University, is a largely unwatchable mess, even by experimental film standards. Though a multitude of 8mm and 16mm images often crowd the screen, there's little to look at and even less to enjoy here. Ray landed the university teaching gig after alcoholism and poverty had decimated his once florid Hollywood career. This movie, which plays more like ugly wallpaper, shows us a Nicholas Ray hobbled by his boozing and thus inattentive to his classroom charges, who apparently learned nothing from him about how to make a movie. Ray obviously was just cashing in his meager teaching pay check here and spends the proceeds on booze and young girls, all of whom appear nude in this film. There are moments of truth here and there, but they're fleeting in the extreme. And in the end, this film's most memorable image has Ray presumably watching dailies from this film with his famed eye patch on, then augmenting that fashion accessory with a second eye patch on the other eye so that he can't see anything. The inevitable DVD release should come complete with such eye patches to preferably be used by the unfortunate viewer.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a sad movie. It's only a curio, only for the most. Well, I was sitting with one of the most diehard Nicholas Ray fans who just posted, Tony Dayoub of the great website Cinema Finder, and Tony had just hosted a Nicholas Ray blogathon, Mm-hmm. And he got up in the middle of it and left.
Wow.
So he was like, I don't have time for this. I can't stand it anymore.
it's about
85 minutes long. I sat through the whole thing, but it was torturous, I have to say. It was torturous. I tried to, like, you know, it's funny. I was sitting with a friend of mine who I'm staying up here with, and she's a writer herself and pretty well-connected. I won't name any names, but... we took a bus back up. We were waiting for a bus back up to her apartment on the Upper West Side, and we saw kind of a dazed viewer out. And we like nudged each other. I bet he just watched the movie because he came to the bus stop and just like wandered past it and then came back, sat down beside us and said, "Oh, did you watch the movie?" He said, "Yeah." So what'd you think? He said, "Oh, I really liked it. What'd you like about it?" He was like, "Oh, well, it said all this stuff about humanity." I said, "What did he say about humanity?" He said nothing about humanity. He said nothing about nothing. He said, "Oh, well, I just thought that it was, you know, I thought that, you know, it had an interesting narrative." And I said, "What was the narrative? There was no story there." And he said, "Well, there was no story." And I said, "The story is narrative. You don't even know what you..." To me, he was just parroting stuff he had heard in film class or
right,
whatever.
Right.
And someone was telling him, you know, namely the film festival, that this was a great movie that needed to be seen, and it was rarely shown. The last time it was shown in New York 8 years ago at MoMA, and it wasn't in this state that it is now. And it is getting ready to be released on DVD.
Interestingly enough, that person that you saw at the bus stop and that raved about the movie, Harry Knowles. I don't know if anybody knows that.
He wasn't in a wheelchair, so I don't think it was him. Doesn't Harry Knowles go around in a wheelchair? I'm not sure.
Yes.
He does, actually, yeah. Or at least, like, yeah. Sometimes, I mean...
And
yeah.
He scoots by with film school opinion badly written that he can't back up. That's
right.
Another way he's handicapped as a critic.
I find Ain't It Cool News to be unreadable.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, so I'm moving on to the bigger titles here. And,
Okay, I'll tell you which ones I want to hear about next.
Mm-hmm.
This season, two of the most perverted films, A Dangerous Method and Shame, star Michael Fassbender. He has gone from X-Man to Triple X-Man, and I want to hear about both the films.
Okay, here we go. We'll start off with A Dangerous Method. There's a moment in David Cronenberg's A Dangerous Method in which Carl Jung, played by Michael Fassbender, and Sigmund Freud, who is played by a radically transformed Viggo Mortensen, are on a boat, and they're approaching that longtime home of all things neurotic, New York City, and they're about to attend a doctor's conference where they will unveil their talking cure called psychoanalysis. Freud puffs on his ubiquitous cigar, and knowing his relationship with Jung has reached an unfixable impasse, he wonders, "Do you think they know that we're bringing the plague with us?" It's a humorous, though bitter moment in Christopher Hampton's witty adaptation of his stage play, also called The Talking Cure, which is in turn an adaptation of John Carr's book, A Most Dangerous Method, which takes much of its content from Freud and Jung's copious letters to each other. But there's a third party here, and that's Sabina Spellrein, a Russian woman played by a committed but often too stagey Keira Knightley. Sabina's malady at the film's beginning is a violent reaction to her adolescent sexual arousal at her own father's beatings of her. Humiliation begets humiliation in Sabina's tangled mind, and this leads her to Jung's office, where the doctor's eyes jump in barely contained delight at her affliction and his opportunity to remedy it. Soon, Sabina is begging Jung to break with ethical boundaries. He wants this cure to involve much more than mere talking, and Freud, in a Semitic whirl of strategy, facilitates Jung's straying. Thus, Cronenberg's newest chilly foray into the human makeup begins to resemble, in inventive ways, Dead Ringers, another film in which two doctors reflective of each other, find a woman standing in the way of their relationship's true consummation. The film might benefit from some previewing research into the nature of psychoanalysis, as it contains a tidal wave of detailed psychogeekery that could be highly amusing to the more informed. However, the forced performance from Fassbender and the really wicked supporting play by Mortensen, coupled with Michael's energy and Hampton's death wordsmithing, really helps Cronenberg achieve his slyly worked out goals. It was a really good movie. I wouldn't go overboard and say it's like my favorite of the year or anything like that, but it's definitely of a piece of Cronenberg's past work, and needs to be seen for all by all fans of Cronenberg and even all fans of film.
Do you think it could be an Oscar contender this year for Cronenberg?
No, I don't think so. I think that the closest it'll come will be Mortensen, supporting actor.
Okay.
But I don't think that it's going to be. Now Hampton might get a screenplay nomination. I don't think it's going to be Cronenberg's ticket into the directing field, and I don't think that it'll get a Best Picture nomination or anything. Mortensen and Hampton are the closest.
Well, we're trying our best to get Cronenberg this month, so keep your fingers crossed.
Okay.
Oh, I hope he comes on.
Cool.
He was extremely amusing in the press conference afterwards. They brought up the sort of dark nature of his past works, and he said, "Huh, I always thought that I was a maker of comedies." he was just always amusing and garnered great laughs. And Fassbender was there as well. I've seen him twice so far at this film festival. Of course, the second time for the next movie that I'm going to review, which is Steve McQueen's Shame. Shame infuriated me. I can't blame it on Michael Fassbender, who delivers an undeniably physical performance as a New York City executive who's disinterested in anything that doesn't involve the stroking of his cock. He's said in the film, and he has a pretty big cock, I'll have to say.
Wow.
Also good in the movie is Carrie Mulligan, who punctures Fassbender's character's emptiness by playing his needy, effervescent sister who disrupts his routine of prostitutes, one-night stands, and internet porn sessions.
And helps her cock.
Right. No, my problem, and we get to see a lot of Carrie Mulligan, by the way. My problem with the movie lies in its screenplay, which shows and never tells. Watching Steve McQueen's follow-up to the superior drama Hunger is like looking at a crime scene photo without any explanation. Yes, there it is. So what? Nearly nothing new here. We have the characters. We have the lead character's cold apartment, devoid of personality. You know, like in American Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I was reminded at this point of a recent quote from John Waters that I found on Facebook that said, you know, if you go into somebody's apartment and there's books around, don't fuck them. and we have, and then of course we have Fassbender's unerring stare, which more often says nothing rather than everything. And we have his work life, which makes one wonder how he's landed such a high-paying job in the first place, much less keep it. Because he seems so stupid. He seems so uninterested in anything. Finally, there's the inevitable rock bottom, an addiction movie staple. Here at least, McQueen's camera captures one indelible image, Fassbender's horribly pained face as he tries to reach orgasm while shoving two exotic girls in tandem. But again, so what? I know a lot of people are love and shame for its supposed bravery, but if the sex in this film had been replaced with something like heroin, I think we'd all fit for the sham that it is.
So do you think it only exists to be provocative and not to necessarily explore what it's about?
there is no exploration in this movie. There is no exploration. There's no attempt to get at a reason why it's happening. There's only sideways glances to the past of siblings played by Fassbender and Mulligan. There's no self-revelatory moment. I mean, I'm not asking for things to be like laid out for me like I would expect them to be laid out, but there's never even any kind of self-revelatory moment of like, for me, the character's main problem is that he's stupid. You know, that he's stupid. He's not interested in anything. You know, I mean, and surely he must have come to some realization about this before he got some kind of sex addiction going on. So I just don't understand, you know, for me, this movie is all about pressing buttons. It's all about showing you the rock bottom and not showing you. I don't even necessarily, there's a little epilogue tacked on the movie that's there to show you, oh, he's changing his ways. But there's nothing to show us that he's really changing his ways. It's just a scene with him staring at something, and you're supposed to go, oh, well, I think he's going to change his ways or whatever. But there's nothing to really give you that kind of thing. There's just no insight into this in this movie. It's just a tour of the trash can.
Okay.
I'll give you another movie.
I'm pretty sure I'm going to love it, right?
Yeah. Sounds that way. Yeah. Sounds like I'll love it too. I mean,
it's really hard to make a movie about sex, but I guess in the long run you have to know that it's not. If you make a movie about sex, that means anything. It's probably in the long run not about sex. It's about why people use sex for a certain goal, you know?
Yes, but I don't know that this character has any goals. I don't know that he has anything in him.
I get that.
And,
but that's what's difficult about
too.
Making a movie like that,
and that's
what they failed at. Yeah.
And, you know, I was sitting next to Tony Dayoub, and he loved it, and he said, that way to kill my butt on Shane, man. And I was like, I'm sorry, but I was just... It was not only all that, by the way. It was boring. I thought it was dull.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be my biggest complaint against it was that I thought it was dull. The only time the movie sprung to life to me, and I know this is to make a point, okay? But so what? It's a great moment in the movie, a great scene in it, where he goes out on a real date with one of his co-workers. And it's a real date, and it progresses like a real date until it derails. And it has a great dinner scene with a very pesky waiter that comes along, and it's very funny. But it was the only moment in the movie that really jumped out. Now, I know that's by design, but I don't want to sit and watch this movie that's going to bore me to tears. I just don't. And it's just not what I pay $13 to go see at a movie. You know, I'm sure that people will love it the same way they loved American Psycho or whatever does it, because some people like to have those buttons pushed. But I didn't care for it. So.
Okay. So what's next?
All right, next. Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene.
Oh, cool.
Sean Durkin, the writer-director of Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, my favorite title of the year, is a master of disorientation. In his debut feature, he puts us right into the dizzy headspace of the film's title character, played with a shell-shocked charisma by Elizabeth Olsen, who is, of course, the younger sister of Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen. From scene to scene, it takes us a bit to determine whether we're seeing Martha as she seeks solace at her sister's lake house, which she shares with her architect husband. This new rich couple are portrayed with compassion and understanding by Sarah Paulson and Hugh Dancy, or whether we're seeing Olsen as Marcy May or Marlene, pledging sexual and domestic allegiance to an upstate New York cult leader, assayed with sinewy menace by John Hawke, Oscar nominated for last year's Stone. The movie is photographed in a murky widescreen by Jody Lee Lights, and it's this shadowy sort of still feature that propels this off-axis character study into a bona fide horror movie territory, surprisingly. Olsen's Martha is truly haunted by her past. She can't even eat without being told it's okay to do so. She jumps and pees her pants at every errant sound. She can't suppress laughter at normal things she now sees as abnormal. And sleep for her is impossible. And even with her reappearance in their lives, strains her sister's marriage to the breaking point. After reading Helter Skelter and seeing the 1981 Canadian film Ticket to Heaven and living through the reportage of 1979's Jonestown Massacre, I don't think there's anything new I can learn about the cult mindset. And so I find the parts of Martha, Marcy May, Marlene that veer in this direction to be cliched. But the film works as a delivery device for Durkin's steady directorial hand, and most primarily as a vehicle for a handful of staying performances spearheaded by its lead. You'll know what I mean when you hear Elizabeth Olsen's voice transform into that hardened devil of a voice as she lays into her sister with a remark that's nearly unforgivable. This is the acting breakthrough of 2011.
Really? You think so?
Oh, yeah. I think it's pretty clear that she's going to get an Oscar nomination for this. And I hear through the grapevine that Albert Nobbs, by the way, is not so great, just from a couple of people that I think that, I can trust. I think she might take Glenn Close's place, and I think she has a strong possibility to get in the critics' awards and things like that. So,
good.
Yeah, it's quite good. It's not a great movie script-wise because of the cult aspect of it. It kind of, scene where John Hawk explains that death is love and everything. Well, that comes right out of Mr. Skelter and the Charles Manson playbook. So I think that it's a subject that fascinated its writer-director, who I went up to after the movie and said, so are you really, out in the lobby? I said, so are you, I just want to ask you, are you into horror movies? And he said, well, my two favorite movies are Rosemary's Baby and The Shining. And I said, that really shows in the movie. And then I told him about the Kubrick series, by the way, and
Thank you.
A little thing that said, you got to tune into the Shining show because it's going to be like a 3-hour epic. You'll be into it. So hopefully you can get him on the show. I liked it. I mean, but I liked it mainly for Elizabeth Olsen and John Hawk. And it goes overboard sometimes. There's a couple of instances of violence in it that just put it into another territory that I don't think works, but it has a very chilling, final few minutes. And
I just want Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, and Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy to have what a double feature. I mean, people are going to have such a difficult time ordering those tickets,
Somebody was saying behind me, I talked to them a little bit, and they said, she might not get an Oscar nomination because sometimes, and this was a whole veteran, the festival, so sometimes, the people who are nominating things, they don't like to nominate things that they can't pronounce, and they're going to have trouble pronouncing Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. And I said, I don't see why anybody would have trouble pronouncing that. I think it just rolls off the tongue.
Mm-hmm.
I totally dismissed that. But
they nominated Jaimin Hunsu, so
yeah,
you never
exactly.
know.
We
have a call that's been online forever from New York. It's a 917. Caller, did you have a question? And now that caller's gone. Okay.
That
gone. Great track record we have with Bigfoot calls.
Okay, I have one more that I've written a review for, and then I have two tiny reviews that I haven't written anything for. So finally, almost finally, My Week with Marilyn premiered today at 10 a.m. And here's my review. Total crowd pleaser with integrity, Simon Curtis's My Week with Marilyn starts off slightly clunkily with Eddie Redmayne's wide-eyed Colin Clark determined to find his way into the British film industry. The film's economy allows the character to land a job with Laurence Olivier's production company, Tootsuite, and just in the right time to meet his first big-screen crush, Marilyn Monroe, who's brought her method-acting ways to the UK and put them on the inevitable collision course with Olivier's traditional acting mores. Kenneth Branagh's bluster as Olivier keeps us entwined in the story of the filming of his final directorial effort, The Prince and the Showgirl, but it is the remarkable Michelle Williams as Monroe that hooks us completely. She appears fleetingly in the first act like a shy vision, but by the second act, she's found a friend and a flirtation in Redmayne's increasingly endearing Colin Clark, who in real life wrote two memoirs about his unique relationship with the superstar. Williams is completely, utterly stunning in this film. She puts to shame every single one of the countless portrayals of Monroe previous to this one, including people who were ripping off Monroe. She gets it all right. The insecurity, yes, but moreover, the instantaneously recognizable sweetness of this hurt bird that reveled in warbling and preening for the joy of every man that admired her, and that indeed was every man. My Week with Marilyn is life. Moving and fast-paced. It'll probably be a huge hit, and it deserves to be, primarily because of Williams, who really seems like she can do no wrong these days. It's really, really... You know, I was sitting here. We went to the theater today, my friend and I, Joanne and I, and she said, oh, we were in the cab going from 116th to 55th. She said, oh, I've got a friend that knew Marilyn and everything, has a big picture of her in the hallway. He knew her. I'm going to call him. So she called this gentleman and got him on the phone. He just happened to be taking a walk. We picked him up at 70th Street. He came in, you know, and he was like, oh, I'm so thrilled. Well, we talked about Marilyn and his experiences with Marilyn. He had hung out with her at the Actors Studio and hung out at Elia Kazan's house with Marilyn at the house and so forth. He'd been in some sort of clinch with her somehow, and he told me one breast was here and one breast was here, and I was just completely in love with her. And he was sitting right next to me during this movie, and it was a very unique way of seeing this film because here was the person who, by the way, is a very he wrote for television back in the 50s and has written plays and so forth. Here was this person sitting right next to me, and at every moment where Michelle Williams got it right, you could just hear him go, "Oh, it's so great! I wish I was there." You know, I mean, you could just feel him go, "Oh, I had that opportunity too." And he was just completely transported by this performance. And he said she just totally got it right. Even though she doesn't strictly look like Marilyn Monroe, she gets everything just right. And
does it play like a coming of age thing?
Does it play like what now?
A coming of age story.
Well, it does. It does with Eddie Redmayne's character, who is, you know, a 22-year-old well-to-do son of privilege who foregoes what his father wants him to do, go to university or whatever, and decides to try his hand at in the film business, and so it does come. But really, what it's kind of like. It is a coming of age as far as his character goes, but it's really a story of kind of like a sweet little friendship with a little bit of flirtation in there. And there's a great, wonderful scene where they have the perfect day together, and you could kind of look at it as kind of Marilyn's last, because the movie doesn't like revel in her drug taking and alcoholism or whatever. You know, there's not a lot of scenes of that. It's mainly a movie about kind of her last grasp at like innocence in some way, before she did Some Like It Hot, and then kind of the spiral downwards. She was still married to Arthur Miller, who's a character in the film, but it kind of disappears and, you know, after a couple of scenes, goes back to the U.S. And, you know, the filmmaker was there, and they said that they stuck pretty closely to what really happened, you know, because, like I said, it is based on the two memoirs. So,
okay, my week with Marilyn. That's another big Oscar contender. The Weinsteins picked it up. So.
Oh, and by the way, Harvey Weinstein was down at the bottom of the staircase, and we gave him the big thumbs up. You know, he said, "Oh, wow!" He liked it. You know, he's like, he's very, very pleased. So,
they made a documentary out of Harvey Weinstein, and it's not seeing the light of day. It's streaming some obscure site online. I wonder why
really?
That happened. I wonder who's behind that.
So true.
That's brave. That's brave for a filmmaker, whether it's established film. I forget who directed it. Whether it's an established filmmaker or a newbie, to set his sights on Harvey Weinstein. Come on. Wow.
For sure.
You want to work ever again? Yeah. All right. Here's the next movie that. That
these
I want to talk to you
would
about.
Have gotten away with murdering me if it would not have been for what you guys did.
Jesse Miskelly told police he watched 18-year-old Damian Eccles and 16-year-old Jason Baldwin brutalize the children as part of a cult ritual.
I was saying what the police wanted me to say.
They were led to believe by the police that we'd done it, but I didn't do it, you know? I didn't have anything to do with it.
Our understanding of what actually happened has changed.
The spacing and the configuration of those injuries is not compatible with a serrated knife or, for that matter, any knife.
How did you get on this jury? And he basically said, dumb judges and dumb lawyers, they don't ask specific questions.
This is more evidence than facts. Than against the West Memphis Three, or me, or anyone else.
You're in a cell 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You never, ever get sunlight.
Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory, which premieres on HBO in January. You've seen it, right?
I have. I have seen it, and it's just as great as the other two are. It's interesting, you know, the film is, I sat watching it with two people who had not seen the original, the first two. And they got it because the film does a very good job of capitulating its previous two entries in the first 10, 15 minutes. So as a result, the movie is kind of a freight train of revelations and information. So you know, if I would say anything about it, there's not room to breathe in it like the other two films, you know, could sometimes provide. But that's not a negative thing at all because. The movie is just as. In fact, I would say that this movie is about probably the most angering out of the three, mainly because of its epilogue. You know, and we all know. You know, I'm not letting anything go. Anybody that's interested in this movie knows how the case turned out. They were brought in. They were said that they were given something called an offered plea. Which basically states that if they would say that they were guilty of the crime, they could go free, which is like total Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass kind of logic, and it is infuriating. It was so infuriating that I could not help myself from screaming at the screen. At the moment where the West Memphis DA comes up and says, well, you know, he's asked, well, what are the reasons that you asked him? You asked him to take the plea? And I said, well, it was to save your fucking ass. They didn't want them to sue them.
Right.
That was
well,
the
exactly.
Big reason. You know, they didn't want them to sue them for wrongful incarceration. And what's worse about it is that they consider this case closed, even though in the film they're, you know, they're pointing again to another suspect in the film that even more than Mark Byers, you know, in the second film, which the filmmakers afterwards said, you know, now they look back on the second film and they feel sorry that they did all that kind of, they framed Mark Byers, or they portrayed Mark Byers as being a suspect, a possible suspect, but they were just doing the job that the police, the incompetent police of that township should have done, you know. The real criminals in this case are the police that couldn't withstand all the criticism and all the hysteria that was being drummed up by the media, and they couldn't withstand it, so they just decided to arrest somebody and be done with it. You know?
And they just wanted to be right and close the book on it. But what's interesting, what you just alluded to, is there's another kind of suspect that they put their eyes on, the filmmakers do anyway, that is very, I mean, he's suspect in the whole thing. That's interesting to me, and also the fact that Byers got on the bandwagon that these kids were not guilty. Do they cover how that transition happened with him?
They do, and they cover it not only just in a factual way, but also in an emotional way. There's a wonderful scene in it where Mark Byers reads a letter that was sent to him by Damien Echols, apologizing, you know, and apologizing for anything that he had said about Mark Byers. And this apology is obviously accepted because it's you know, then we see Byers, you know, really getting on the bandwagon against this other person you know, there's witnesses behind, and there's a timeline. I mean, Byers even, you know, takes the time to like do like a very elaborate kind of pro and con kind of display, you know, where you can like put it up on an easel or whatever, and he does this pro and con display, and the pro against the you know, the facts against the West Memphis 3 are like two facts. And then the facts against this other individual, you know, are like ridiculous, you know. And again, there's witnesses that weren't canvassed that should have been, you know, that didn't know that they should come forward or whatever, which to me is also like ridiculous. Like if you had some kind of knowledge of the case and it'd been going on for 18 years like it's been, why would you? If you had some kind of like suspicion that, hey, these guys aren't, why wouldn't you, if you were that witness, why wouldn't you just come forward and say what you had to say rather than wait for the police to come to you or whatever, or the filmmakers or whatever. But I mean, it's an infuriating movie, completely infuriating, yeah. But particularly in its final 15 minutes.
What's great about this whole series is that, this whole documentary series, that, I mean, HBO got it started. I mean, HBO commissioned it. They wanted it to be made. Is that it's changed history. I mean, it's shaped the history of the story itself. So, I mean, this is a real example of kind of the power of filmmaking and documentary filmmaking in particular to kind of rally, you know, a unified, you know, people were very moved by it, and they became active because of this movie. They became activists for these kids.
Interestingly, the day after, a couple of days after I watched it, I rewatched on the table up here. I rewatched, you know, part of The Thin Blue Line, and
right.
I realized why they were showing that is because of the, you know, the Paradise Lost thing. Of course, it owes, you know, this film series, you know, owes a lot to Thin Blue Line. So, you know,
which is still absolutely a movie I cannot get through. I have tried four times to watch that movie, and I don't know what it is. I cannot get through it.
Is it the pace of it or what?
It strikes me as a 1980s criminal investigation on television kind of thing.
I can understand that because the person I was watching it with we had a discussion afterwards, and I said, no, this movie was tremendously influential. I mean, it was tremendously controversial when it came out because it did include, very creative use of film in terms of illustrating the story, and also in that vein, also using recreations, and so much of that has so much of what Errol Morris did in that film has been appropriated by people who make reality TV crime stories.
Right.
So
that's not his fault. I mean, he set a standard, mm-hmm. and it's been
right.
hacked to death since. So, I mean, as a result, that movie feels old-fashioned to me. I couldn't get involved in it, even though I know the importance of it. I know that it freed a wrongfully imprisoned man. But, you know, I couldn't get into the – I've only seen two Errol Morris documentaries, and I didn't like the other one I saw, which was Standard Operating Procedure,
mm-hmm.
which was
kind of
like –
I didn't like that one either. I thought that was
the opposite. I thought he styled it to death.
I thought so too.
Instead of telling a story straight, I mean, he kind of blew it. So I'll give him more chances because obviously he has a lot more movies out there. But I love documentaries.
Definitely take a chance on Gates of Heaven, which is still Robert.
I have that here.
It's one of his favorite movies.
Yeah.
And Roger Ebert says, and I don't know that I necessarily agree, though I like the movie, but he says that movie, Gates of Heaven, is impossibly layered with meaning, you know,
mm-hmm.
it's got, you know, layers and layers of meaning that he finds in it that just blow him away and still do. He's still writing about that movie, you know.
He's watched more often than any. He's
right.
watched that movie hundreds of times. That's why I rented it. So I will check it out. Let Jerry, did you see the George Harrison, speaking of documentaries?
Yes, I did.
Okay, I saw it too. Dean talked about it last week, so let's get your take on it.
I think the second night, the second part, is one of the most inspirational things I've seen.
Yeah.
I think that with the, you know, with Steve Jobs passing, that's enough to make you want to do anything. I think the second half of, I mean, I like the first half too, but the second night, I mean, to break this into two parts is smart. But I mean, you gain such an appreciation for Harrison as an individual. I can't stress that enough because I didn't know a lot about him. Even when he passed away, I didn't know a lot about him. But you gain such an appreciation for just what it means to live watching this film. I like Scorsese's previous film about Bob Dylan. I think this eclipses that a hundredfold. I think this is just an amazing film.
I was reading a Pauline Kael review the other day, and I think she was reviewing something like Lady Sings the Blues or something,
mm-hmm.
and she liked it, but she liked it. Are you at like a Chinatown now?
Yeah, where are you, Dean? Where?
I'm right outside a building that serves as a dorm for girls at Barnard College. So
well,
there's lots of
it figures
young
you'd be
girls.
There.
Dean, are you going to get arrested?
Yeah, pretty soon. Okay, so but she said that what Lady Sings the Blues does not do, that is the hardest thing to do when you do a biopic on an artist, is to illustrate where the art comes from. I thought that's what this movie did very well, George Harrison,
mm-hmm.
Scorsese's doc. It's a great portrait of an artist and a human being. This
mm-hmm.
is what I wrote about it, and how the two find each other and kind of work in harmony.
Mm-hmm.
So you truly see how he's searching as a person and how that is expressed through his music. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you see where the art comes from. And I think when it comes to making a movie about a spiritual journey, I think Scorsese's perfect for it. So I was really taken, and I was very inspired by the second part of
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
As
and
you
not,
were.
Yeah, but not that the first part is bad or anything. It's just the second thing just hits you over the head in a good way, and you're just, like, so inspired. And because I didn't know a lot of this stuff. I mean, Harrison was always growing up. We didn't know him. I mean, at least I didn't know a lot about him. It was always John and Paul.
And remember, he was very secretive in his life anyway, you know, so there was no reason that you would know about those things. He didn't go on tour like the others did. He didn't go out and protest like Lennon did. There's your siren in the background.
Wow, you're really bringing it out now that they know that you're out there. I mean,
But the thing about the first part, I guess the first part doesn't feel as fresh because it's going through the history that it has to get that stuff out of the way, and it's the Beatles, the history with the Beatles, how popular they were, why they broke up, blah, blah, blah. And what's interesting about that first part compared to the second half is that it doesn't play chronologically.
No,
and
it doesn't. Right.
He kind of mixes it up, and he mixes it up into segments.
Mm-hmm.
He takes a particular song that expresses that period of their career and their lives and makes them into individual segments.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I felt like the first part of it breathed kind of new life into a story that I have seen like a thousand times before.
Mm-hmm.
And like as opposed to something like the Lennon documentary that I saw as part of American Masters last year at the festival, or anything about the Beatles, or anything, when something comes to the Beatles, I already know everything and everything. So, unlike other things about the Beatles, with that part of this documentary, I still felt engaged. I mean, the choices of other media that they showed, including showing Harrison's own pictures. You know, like when you see a click of Harrison's camera above the crowd at the Platt Hotel in New York when they first arrived. Then you see the photograph that he took, you know, the sort of fisheye lens kind of photograph that he took. I thought all of that stuff just enlivened the...
I was engaged, too.
I was
engaged, too, but he's telling a story that's already been told. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah.
And that's why the second...
It's boring. It's not that it's boring or anything, but we feel like we're going through familiar terrain, but it's just the second half. I mean, wow. I mean, it's just like...
But you do, that being said, you do need to watch the first half.
Oh, yeah, you do.
To get the continuity of who George Harrison was, where he came from, for the second half to pay off. I mean, don't avoid.
It's not saying the first half is bad, not at all.
Right, right.
I thought it was great to see, like, for instance, the footage of them signing the papers almost at the beginning of the movie, signing the papers of the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
That was something that I had never seen before. Things like that, you know, interviewing Kircher, the photograph she took.
This is what I want to say. Phil Spector's in the movie. And when I heard Phil Spector and looked at him, I said, oh, my God, Pacino's so perfect for this role.
I mean, I was thinking of you while watching that. Yeah.
He is perfect. Because I guess I'd seen Spector talk before. I mean, there's been a documentary made about Spector just last year that hasn't really seen the light of day very much. But I saw a little preview of it. But this is the first, like, sustained time that I've heard Spector speak. And with that voice that's like this, and I thought, oh, God, this is going to be such a great part for Pacino. I was so excited. So anyway.
I wanted to touch up for one other movie that I saw, which was from the Dardenne brothers from Belgium. It's called The Kid with the Bike. It's very much of a piece of their past movies, a kind of a fairy tale kind of thing about a kid who has a father who abandoned him, and he literally runs into her at a clinic or something and knocks her over and clutches her. And she says, oh, you can hold me, but don't hold me so tight. And from there, she kind of takes him under her wing, even though he's still struggling with giving up with his past life, with his father, who is a very uncaring, you know, the Darden Brothers movies always have some, or at least the ones I've seen, always have some kind of uncaring parent in it. You know, some kind of parent that's, you know, not paying attention in some way. And it was a wonderful movie with a great, you know, lead performance by a kid that was, that the Darden said was the fifth kid that they looked at, and they said, he's right, but we have to look at 150 other kids just to do the process correctly.
Mm-hmm.
But this kid is played by Thomas Doré, and it's a tremendous performance, and so is Cecile de France, the woman that kind of takes him in. It's a beautiful movie, and a beautiful, you know, sometimes hard-hearted movie. So I don't want to like say that it's completely sentimental, but it has that aspect to it. That's kind of a piece of the Darden's last movies. This was the winner of the Grand Jury Prize at this year's Cannes Film Festival. Definitely worth seeing, and it does have distribution through Sundance. So if you like good foreign films, this is one to check out.
Okay. So what's coming up next week for you? What are the highlights of the upcoming week?
Well, left to see this week, as far as press screenings go, I've found that I can use my press pass to get into other screenings as well as special events if there's room. So left this week is a film called Footnote, which I know little about. Also the Almodovar film, The Skin I Live In, with Antonio Banderas, who I understand he's going to be on the show, isn't he?
Wednesday night, yeah.
Okay. And then also on Wednesday, I see the documentary about Corman, Roger Corman, called Corman's World, and another film called Vito. Then I'll see a Danish film called Goodbye First Love, and a Swedish film called Play. And then finally on Friday, October 14th, I'll be seeing The Artist, the Hasnavicius movie, which is getting a lot of great buzz, and I think it's going to be a front runner for the Oscar this year. And finally, the closing night movie is The Descendants, Alexander Payne movie with George Clooney. So I'll be reporting on those as well as I'm going to try to get in on Thursday night. I don't know if I'll be able to get into this, but I'm going to try. The one special event I'm going to try to get into is the 10th anniversary showing of Royal Tenenbaums with a reunion of the cast and with Wes Anderson in attendance. And he's supposed to be giving a talk sometime this week also at the Apple Store. The Apple Store is somewhat of a constant fixture at the festival for talks being given by a lot of the principals of the most interesting movies here, so I'm going to try and
did you check out what screenings there were of that Incendiary movie?
I didn't, but I will iron that out and see if I can go and check it out.
Okay.
I'll make
Incendiary
a note on that.
And those filmmakers will be on next Sunday. Incendiary is, there was this piece written in the New Yorker a couple of years ago about this house that burned down and the two children died in the fire, and the father was charged with their murder and he was executed when there was no evidence to back that he actually killed his children intentionally or at all. And I thought it was like the best piece of investigative journalism I've read in a long time, and they've made a documentary out of it. So those filmmakers will be on next Sunday. And Antonio Banderas this Wednesday to talk about The Skin I Live In, the Almodovar. We also have the score for that
sort
movie
of,
that we'll play Wednesday,
sort of
too.
Sort of a horror movie, sort of his tribute to horror movies.
Yeah.
In a way.
And you know who Almodovar is influenced by? One of his primary influences is Brian De Palma. He adores Brian De Palma. And doesn't that fit with his kind of lurid, outlandish style? I mean,
yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
right.
Banderas has worked with De Palma before, as has his wife. So we will be talking about that.
Very interesting.
So, all right, before we close off our show with our interview, Dean, I want to say that I did see Tree of Life.
Okay.
And I hadn't seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
Did you read my review of it? Did you read my review of it on Filmicability at all? Did you?
I heard you talk about it a lot here on my show too.
Yeah.
So.
Well, let's hear what you had to say, because this I've been waiting for us for since May or June. So please.
Yeah. Well, I know that I will be living with this movie for a long time, and I think. It's a tie for me between this and Badlands as the great Terrence Malick movies. I think that people, if they don't get into it, I think they have a problem giving themselves over to a movie. And I think they're too focused on interpreting the movie than just letting it happen. I said, when you first watch the movie, it's a movie that you intuit rather than interpret. You have to kind of let it overwhelm your senses,
right.
And you get it. If you feel it, you get it. There wasn't really much ambiguity or huh moments in the movie for me, because it's all about the feeling for me. It's incredibly ambitious, but I thought it was a great movie about memory. And the one thing that a movie doesn't have is like a sense of smell, and if smell-o-rama not included, but if you when smells kind of bring up memories for you and stuff, this movie, the sound design does that for you. I mean, they're just a symphony of sounds that just feel like childhood to me, even if it's not the childhood that you lived in the Midwest. It's so kind of universal, these moments. And I think. The bottom line is, that's what the movie's about. It's kind of the universality of the human experience.
I agree with that 100%.
It goes to the beginning of the universe. I mean, that's what the movie is about.
This is a good thing, because I do want to ask both of you, now that all three of us have seen the movie, there are two things I want to ask about, and I guess, at this point, I guess we still have to say spoiler. But there are two things I want to ask about. The first one being, obviously, when Sean Penn goes up into the building, up in the elevator, and up that scene, that is the afterlife. Am I not mistaken? That is heaven.
I have a personal view of all of that stuff. Oh. Talk about all the stuff on the beach and all that stuff too. Or my personal opinion on that is not that it's the afterlife. It is a moment. It is not a place, but it is a feeling, just like the movie itself is filled with. This place that he goes to is not an actual place. It's not a place, in some realm of time. It's in a realm of feeling, and it is the place where you make forgiveness and have forgiveness for all the things that you've done and all of the people that might have done you wrong and might have affected you badly, might have affected you for positive or whatever. Remember, you're also seeing in that scene not only Sean Penn as an adult, but you're also seeing Hunter McCracken as Sean Penn as the child. So how can it be the afterlife?
It can be the afterlife. Actually, pop culture betrays your instinct right there, because one of the most important pop culture afterlife events, I think, of the last decade is the Lost series finale, where the father says to the son, "There is no now."
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Having said that, I do think, because we don't know, we have no. I mean, at least unless you're not telling me something, Dean. Unless you have been beyond and back. I actually think that makes perfect sense that is at the afterlife, because I think to me, when he goes up in that building, I mean, that's the film. You said the film, the scene where Brad Pitt goes on vacation or whatever, where leaves the family is the most. I couldn't stop crying during that. I've only seen the movie once. I don't think I need to watch the film again because it left such a vivid imprint on me. I couldn't stop crying during that sequence when they're in the afterlife. I was in tears. That whole time, because
it goes back to the question of, and this has been written about, is is Tree of Life a biblical epic? I mean, because they
the
invoke the book
epic,
of
I think.
They invoke the book of Job quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Christianity informed Malick's childhood.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. It's very spiritual. I think the movie's constructed so that you don't have to take it literally as
right.
the afterlife. But if you're inclined to do that, that's certainly a possibility there.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't tell you what the ending is.
No, it
what
doesn't.
What I take it is as either one. You know, I'm like, it could be the afterlife, or it could be this movie having been a movie about memory.
Mm-hmm.
All of those memories are there, converged in one spot. That's
right.
his climax. That's where he ends up.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets down on his knees. He needs to make peace with his life experience.
Right.
And he's surrounded by it.
The other question I want to ask you is there's this scene, this image that keeps popping up at time to time of the attic. That, you know, the tall figure in the attic.
Sure. Right.
Is that purgatory?
That's an interesting question. You know, that's the kind of question that I personally can't answer, really, because I think that the movie is filled with kind of questions that really a second viewing or even a third viewing or beyond can actually answer for you, at least internally. I think that the movie is filled with these kind of things that are just touched upon just in one single image, like the image of you know, Jessica Chastain floating up or her being in that glass coffin in the middle of the woods, or just tons of things like that in this movie that I think say a lot and say a lot about of the film's themes and the feelings that, and ideas that they're trying to transmit
right.
at that very moment. And I think
you know what
second,
though
third
I also,
viewing can
I also think
things.
That I don't recall when the tall man in the attic appears.
I just remember that image a couple, you know, it appears throughout the movie a couple of times. It's just like, wow,
when does it appear? I don't know when it appears.
Oh, I don't
maybe
remember,
that,
Jamie. It's been like 4 or 5 months, so I don't remember.
What I'm saying is maybe it reflects what his father is to him.
Yes, that's true.
You know, very larger-than-life, imposing.
I think you bring up a good point about memory, though. It is, when we think back on our memories and we think about our earliest memories, that they are fragmented like that. And I think that is Malick's genius. This may be the film that he is at the end of things remembered for, because he does bring, they're like I said, I think when we talked about this originally, you feel like a voyeur into someone's home movies that they're showing on their Super 8 projector.
Yes.
And you feel like that. I think that for, you know, that while you're watching it initially, you're like, wow, these are very personal home movies.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know,
I think
it's worth being said that with this movie and Moneyball, Brad Pitt gives two of the best performances of the year.
Without a doubt.
No holds barred.
Yeah.
I mean, I got no reservations about saying
no,
that.
No, of course not.
He needs to be recognized for this
about
for this
time.
Work.
I mean,
you know
what? He's got to get some recognition at the end of the year for one or both of those performances. Although I
and speaking of
Moneyball
the performances,
yet, so.
You need to see Moneyball. It's an entertaining movie. But speaking of performances, so Sean Penn, the other big story about Tree of Life is that Sean Penn, while not outright disowning it, he's mystified by the final movie because he read a script that was the most beautiful thing he ever read, and the movie wasn't that script. And so he was kind of, what the hell am I doing in this movie?
Right.
Now, there is a director's cut that will include all of his stuff in it. I think when it came to making the theatrical cut, Malick knew the essentials. He knew what was essential in that movie, and that's what's in that movie. I don't know why Sean Penn feels like he has to bad talk the movie. I would be so proud to
be part of it. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's the same thing. Like when we were talking about James Horner mouthing Malick for what he did with Thin Red Line or whatever. You know, it's like, or Christopher Plummer or whatever. Look, just because you're in the movie doesn't mean the movie is about you. You know, just because.
And plus, he made a completely wrong-headed statement, I think. And I like Sean Penn a lot. I think he's really intelligent. The thing that I like most about him is that he has integrity as an artist, you know,
mm-hmm.
and as a person. But his wrongheaded comment was, you could have made it more linear, like a more regular narrative flow, and it would have lost none of its beauty or meaning. I don't think that's the case at all.
I wouldn't have done it that way.
I think the movie makes, you know, if, depending on how you look at it, but I think it makes perfect sense. I don't think, and I think to say that really, it discredits Sean Penn in some way. It's like, dude, come on. I mean, these are the kind of films you champion, supposedly. Come on.
Yeah.
I mean,
how
could you get involved in any kind of Malick film? This should just be like some kind of, all of this stuff, Sean Penn's comments and everybody else's comments, should just be a thing that anybody else that gets involved with Malick or whatever, if they think they know going in what the final movie is going to be, even if they've read the script and understand their character and everything, or understand exactly what their part in it is, the final product is not necessarily going to be what you thought it was going to be. I would think that would be wonderful.
it's a movie of memory.
Yeah.
Who remembers? Who has memories that play linear?
Yeah, I don't.
I mean,
exactly.
Memories are moments. And that's why you have these quick shots of moments.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
That's why
you can walk down the street and go, oh, I remember I was here, and then it'll be gone, you know, because you're ensconced in your own, the life that you're living at the moment.
Right.
I think it's still the best movie of the year, I think. Still the best movie of the year.
I think so, too. I think it's the shining accomplishment. So, good. We're all in agreement about that.
Yeah, it's good.
Let me say this. Even if you hated Tree of Life, if you thought it was just the absolute worst thing, there's no denying the film's ambition and scope. I mean, you just can't. You can't, even if you're not fond of Terrence Malick, which obviously there are a lot of people who aren't, you can't deny the film's ambition. I mean, you really can't. I mean, you really have to say, at the end of the day, this is a daring movie. Regardless of where you stand on it, you would have to be like, wow, this filmmaker wants to talk about memories, childhood, and he wants to include all this stuff, and it's a gamble, but I think it's a gamble worth taking. I mean,
and I think the people that hate it are lazy.
I think there's some truth to that.
I agree.
And I don't mean to paint somebody with
Terrence Malick did something impossible.
Yeah.
He made a red state movie that blue state people could love. And
yeah.
I hate to use those terms, but that's what he did.
But I agree with that.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that people – I went back and read some reviews, and I'm always – I don't get upset about, like, angry reviews. I'm kind of – I laugh at them. So anything that Rex Reed writes, I laugh at. Rex Reed despised Tree of Life. He thought it was the most pretentious thing on the planet.
It is, but it's not bad, though.
I don't know that the movie is pretentious, because tell me what kind of point he's trying to hammer on the head, and then you can tell me how it's pretentious. I think the people that say it's pretentious just don't get it. You know?
I think it is, but not in a bad way. I don't think pretentious is bad. That's my problem. That's probably why people have, like, my mass graves made up for me, ready to be shot and put in them. But I don't think pretentious is a bad thing. I think pretentious in some ways is a good thing. But I think it's pretentious because it makes you – if pretentious in this day and age is making you think, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm also saying about the melancholy of film as well. If it makes you think, then obviously being asked to think in this day and age is a bad thing. God forbid that you should be made to think about what something means, a book or a movie or a song.
Well, even more than that, like I said, I didn't necessarily think about it too much when I was seeing it. I experienced it, and people, but you have to meet the film.
Mm-hmm.
You have to meet the film halfway. You just can't sit in it like a freaking roller coaster and let it happen to you like that. I mean, and so when some artist is trying so clearly to be so ambitious,
mm-hmm.
You owe it to that film to at least make an effort to get on its wavelength.
I agree with that. Look, I saw this the same weekend, and I got it. You all probably want to shoot me. The X-Men film, which I thought would suck, and that was good too. But my only problem with the X-Men film is that there's now lots of students who think that the X-Men helped the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's my big issue with that film. That they think, hey, where's Magneto? When we don't learn about this in history class. But no. But I think Tree of Life, you're right. It does ask you to meet you, to meet the director, and to follow his vision. But I it's not any movie that asks that of you can't be a bad film in this day and age. But I think if you go into a Malick film, you sort of know what you're getting into, if you know his previous work. If you don't, hopefully it will make you want to seek out some of the older titles in that.
And that's why Fox Searchlight is great. I mean, Fox Searchlight had the balls to release this wide or, you know, expanded markets. I mean, it wasn't a limited release.
It wasn't.
Yeah. And so bravo to them. I mean, there's a studio that supports the artist.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
What Weinstein used to be. Even though Weinstein is releasing the artist, literally.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway.
Oh.
All right, Dean, we appreciate your report.
Okay. And I'll be back on, I guess we'll be back on Wednesday, right? So
we will
I'll
be Wednesday night.
Wednesday night,
okay.
Yeah.
I'll do a report on Wednesday.
We need you at 10:30. We need you at 10:30 after Antonio Banderas.
Okay, and then next Sunday you'll hear the rest of it and the wrap up.
Okay.
So.
Okay, sounds good.
Well, thanks, guys, and we'll talk to you on Wednesday.
All right, cool.
Thank you, man.
Bye-bye.
See
you later. Bye.
All right, New York Film Festival still going on. We'll have continuing reports from the festival on Wednesday and Sunday night. Night. Okay. Before we get into our final interview, because we're going to close out the show with the final interview, so the show will actually end when the interview ends.
Okay.
You see how
right.
that works?
Yeah, I understand. I actually do. I can't comprehend it. Thank you.
See how it works is the train moves, not the station. That's one of my all-time favorite lines. Let's play this little piece of film score because I need to premiere one of these film scores. They're piling up.
Okay.
Here's a little 2.5 minute piece from the new score from I Don't Know How She Does It. By
well, that's a Sarah Jessica Parker movie, right?
That's right.
That's Come
right.
and Gone.
I don't know how it did it, but. But here's Aaron Zygmunt's score for that film, and then we'll be back in 2.5 minutes to introduce the closing guest segment. Okay, that is composer Aaron Zygmunt. The soundtrack for I Don't Know How She Does It is now available. Also, speaking of movie entertainment, there's an exclusive offer for Movie Geeks United listeners for cinema books from Applause Books and Limelight Editions. Mm-hmm. Applause Books is actually the publisher that released the book that we're about to discuss on Jerry Orbach. Applause, if you go to applausebooks.com or limelighteditions.com, this is all part of the Hal Leonard Publishing Company. Any cinema book they have, you'll get a 20% discount if you're a Movie Geeks United listener, plus free shipping.
That's
so
a good deal.
If you put AP2, A as in Adam, P as in paddle, and 2 is in the number 2, you can, man, that's perverted, Adam, paddle, number 2. Okay, if you enter that code in the checkout, you can get 20% off plus free shipping on any of their film-related books, and we're going to cover many of them over the coming weeks. They have a lot of great releases. We're also going to do like a series on musicals, and they soon.
Oh, cool!
The early part of next year, because we haven't really covered musicals very much.
No, that'd be awesome. That'd be very interesting.
So that'll be good stuff. And they have a whole series of music on film. A lot of great stuff. They actually also have a great, great hefty volume on the vampire film that we're going to give away to a lucky listener. So I'll announce it right now. If you send us at moviegeeksunited.com, no, moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. Send me your favorite vampire movie and why it's your favorite, and you'll be in the running to receive a beautiful edition of the vampire film, a great book, and we'll give you more details on that later in the week. Okay, but our final segment is a guest, a great author by the name of John Gilvey. He's written an essential biography on one of our great character actors, Jerry Orbach. You might remember from Law and Order and Crimes and Misdemeanors, Prince of the City, which is the subtitle of his book, and a lot of great work, including Chinese Coffee with Al Pacino, which
That's right.
One of the last things he did, really. We talk about all those and more with Mr. Gilvey. The book is now available. You can purchase it from that link that we've provided on the show page for you. So we'll close out with this interview. Jerry, thank you for another great show.
Yeah, thank you. It was a lot of fun. It was very informative. It was a good one. And we'll see everyone on Wednesday night.
Wednesday night, Antonio Banderas.
Antonio Banderas. Cool. Very cool.
That'll be good.
Yeah,
all right, guys. Here's John Gilvey. Good night.
Good night.
What were your personal experiences with Mr. Orbach, and what made him a worthwhile subject for you for a biography?
Well, when I was a doctoral student in educational theater at New York University, writing my dissertation, Jerry Orbach gave me one of the essential interviews that helped me write my dissertation on Broadway director-choreographer Gower Champion. Jerry was in two of Gower's shows, Carnival and 42nd Street. In fact, he called them the bookends of his Broadway career. And one of the musicals I was studying at the time was Carnival. So I had just happened to go backstage after a performance of 42nd Street. This was a production he was taking on tour around 1992, just before he started on Law and Order. And he was just so personable. He said, I explained to him what I wanted to do, and he said, absolutely, John, here's my number and my address. Give me a call. I'll be back in New York in a few days, and I'll not only tell you about Carnival, but also 42nd Street, because sometimes these dissertations, well, they become biographies and get published. Mm-hmm. And he was right about that, because that dissertation eventually became Before the Parade Passes by, Gower Champion, and the Glorious American Musical. So when that book had run its course, it's like anything else, I guess. You know, in theater, they say you're only as good as your last show. Well, you're only as good as your last book. You got to write another. And I got on the subway on the way to work one day and looked up, and there was Jerry looking down at me from this advertisement for the New York iBank, and as if to say, well, what about the interview I gave you? And so right away I thought, oh, that's right. You know? And from there it was a question of connecting with his widow, Elaine Cancillo-Orbach. And Elaine had read the Gower book and said, I think you're the man for the job. So we went on from there. And unfortunately, Elaine passed in the process of me writing the book, but was very instrumental in linking me with Jerry's mother and sons and other members of the family, and of course all his colleagues that I interviewed for the book. So I guess that's how this has come about, Jamie.
You know, for those that are not familiar with his stage work, and I was not familiar with that aspect of his career, I mean, I would think that the masses know him best probably from his unprecedented stint on Law and Order, and seeing his work on that show and in the various films that he's done over the years. Musical theater is kind of the last place that you'd think
that
of your robot.
Yes, and you know, students and so forth today, when I teach, they're just completely baffled to see him as a musical theater performer, and I may add, a quintessential musical theater performer. He was tops. He was the best. And of course, I'm older, so I remember that time very well. In fact, the first time I saw Jerry on stage was not in a musical, but in a play. He had done a revival of Tennessee Williams' The Rose Tattoo, playing Mangiacavallo opposite Maureen Stapleton, recreating her Tony Award-winning role as Serafina Del Rose at the Walnut Street Theater in Philadelphia. And I brought my high school class there to see the production, and he just commanded the stage. I just remember him charging down this serpentine flight of steps a mile a minute to woo Maureen Stapleton at the bottom, and he was just someone you just simply did not take your eyes off of when he was on stage. He resonated and focused your attention so on him.
He was a very strong, authentic presence.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. But what characterize, as you are a great lover and student and teacher of the Broadway musical, what characterized his performances in the musical specifically?
Well, he came in at a time when actors were having a major impact on the American musical, you know, beginning with, a Yul Brynner in The King and I in 1951, thereabouts, and Rex Harrison in My Fair Lady, 56, and so forth. And he was a his presence in musicals really. Jerry was first and foremost an actor. He wasn't a singer who also acted, or for whom acting was secondary. He was an actor first, because what he really wanted, essentially, as I guess so many actors do, is a film career. And James Dean, Montgomery Clift, Marlon Brando, they were all his idols. And, you know, he's in high school and college in the early 50s when those three actors are really making their mark in the film industry. So, you know, that's what he wanted for himself. And he studied at the Actors Studio with Lee Strasberg and so forth, and in an effort to inculcate the method and so forth that they had learned. Mm-hmm. So that was what he brought to the music. And unfortunately, you know, he wasn't Tony Curtis and he wasn't Tab Hunter, and that's what Hollywood was casting in those days, pretty much. And so he had trouble breaking into film because he was not the juvenile lead, so to speak. You know, he was darker and a little more on the I guess you might even say the sinister side, you know, because of some of the roles that he played. And that played out on stage as well. He began in 1956 with the off-Broadway production of Three Penny Opera, playing the street singer, which is a kind of a sinister type of role in Bertolt Brecht's and Kurt Weill's stage show. And from there went on to El Gallo in The Fantastics, again, kind of a dark role as well. And from there on to Broadway in as Paul Berthollet, the lame puppeteer in Carnival. So for a while there, he was succumbing to the fear that all actors have of being typecast. My God, you know, please don't do this to me.
Right.
So he always really took his career firmly in hand and tried to steer it in another direction so that he would not be typecast.
Promises, promises, I'm all through with promises, promises now. I don't know how I got the nerve to walk out. If I shout, remember, I feel free. Promises end. I won't pretend that what was wrong can be right. Every night I'll sleep now, no more lies. Things that I promised myself fell apart, but I found my heart. Oh, promises, they're kind of promises, take all the joy from life. Promises can just destroy your life. Oh, promises, promises, my kind of promises can lead to joy and hope and love. Yes,
when you look at his earliest years, what about acting was fit for him? What did it fulfill in him?
Well, there's a line that comes to mind. Mira Ostrova, who was his acting one of his acting teachers at the Actors Studio, had asked him in class one day, why do you act? And he said, well, I guess it's because I want people to love me. And she said, no, not at all, not at all. You want people to respect you. That's why you act. And I think to have earned, as he did, the respect of his peers in the business along the way, that was a major compliment to him. I recall a story that he told about Ruth Gordon sending a note back stage the night after she had seen him in his Tony Award winning role in Promises, Promises, and Alfred Lund and Lynn Fontanne said the same thing. So all three of them, Garson Cannon and the author and director as well, all four of them had been there the night before and had said what a superb job he had done, that everybody should see this performance of you as Chuck Baxter in Promises, Promises. And So to earn that kind of respect from his peers, I think that's really something that Jerry certainly very much valued and appreciated in his professional career.
Yeah. In terms of his film and television career, were there performances that he was proudest of, that he felt represented the best of his ability?
Oh, well, I definitely think his 12 years with Law and Order would rank up there. But one thing that does come to mind, Jamie, is the film in 1981 that he did, Prince of the City. That's a major breakthrough for Jerry. That's the kind of thing he had tried for and fell short of along the way. And I think at the time, the role that he played of Gus Levy, the best friend of Treat Williams' character in that film, the character that the film is about, is probably a real turning point in his career. The critics were saying, with the superlative acting ability that he has, why has he been hanging out in musicals all these years? You know, that could get, and that's the truth. And you do what you're given to do, and that's
right.
And after that, things started to go better for him. Of course, what comes after that is Dirty Dancing and
Crimes and Misdemeanors. Oh, wonderful movie!
That,
yeah,
that really. And that, he said, "I really loved doing that role of I believe it's Jake in Crimes and Misdemeanors, because it's."
Mm-hmm.
I could sink my teeth into as an actor, and that one scene. I'm thinking of the one scene that he and Martin Landau are plotting the death of Landau's girlfriend, walking around the house that's all summer house that's all locked up for the winter, and it's such a fabulous scene, and you sense that they are two brothers, two bloods,
yeah,
plotting this murder. Yeah,
and he delivers it so matter-of-factly. The morality does not come into play. It's a classic.
No.
It's a classic Woody Allen role.
This is what we do for a living. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing unusual here.
And also, what a tremendous advantage that his breakthrough movie being Prince of the City, that he was being directed by one of the ultimate actors, directors,
Sidney
Lumet.
Yes. Yeah.
Hmm.
And, it's interesting because Sidney Lumet had wanted to cast him in the leading role in Bye Bye Braver Man, I believe it was. The role went to... Jack, the actor, I just can't think of his name offhand. Jack Warden. Jack Warden, I believe, played the role. Jerry was too young. That was basically it at the time. And but it's interesting that Lumet came back to him in 81 and said, this role of Gus Levy, the supporting role in the film I'd like to play.
You know, one other film that I'd like to talk about, and I think it's probably his last great, great performance and criminally underseen, is Chinese Coffee.
Oh, I'm so glad you're bringing that up.
Well, I am a Pacino
really
fanatic, so of course.
Well, this is a film that truly is underrated. It really, really is. It's just overlooked, and I don't know why. But it's a tour de force between two of the finest actors we know. You know. And it's a and like yourself, it's a personal favorite of mine as well.
Yeah, and it seems so rare, and it seems like that would be such a comfort zone for him, that kind of project, mm-hmm. because you're dealing with two stage veterans, a two character piece, and they're just working it out, just toe to toe, all the way. I mean, that seems like it would have been heaven for him.
Absolutely, and the thing that Al Pacino brings out is the fact that he himself, Al, had 2 years to perfect his role, and Jerry had like 3 weeks because they filmed it while he was on summer break from Law and Order. And, you know, Jerry had to get to the level of Al's performance within 3 weeks' time, which he did, of course. But Al had wanted him to do the role on stage with him when he was performing it. But, of course, Jerry was tied up. He was contracted to Law and Order at the time, and he wasn't able to do that. Mm-hmm. But the moods and the darkness and the light throughout that film in terms of the revealing what's beneath these characters and so forth, the way the two of them go about that. And, of course, that's also a credit to Ira Lewis, the playwright, the author. You know, it's just phenomenal to me how every time I see it, I see something I didn't see before in terms of the performance and the nuance, you know, that both actors bring to the roles.
I think so too, and it's such a kind of an acting masterclass, and you feel it's one of those projects where you feel that their love of acting is coming through in their. And their performances, and it's infectious, absolutely.
You want to take a walk to Chinatown?
Chinatown? No, I decidedly do not.
Why not?
Because it's 1:30 in the morning, because it's February, because it's freezing outside, because I don't like Chinatown, because we don't have any money.
It's brisk. It's a nice walk. Come on, we'll get some coffee with milk. So we got enough money for that.
You don't need coffee, Chinese or otherwise. Give me that cup. Look at yourself.
The worst coffee
ever. You're shaking, trembling. You don't need, you need to be clubbed, not prodded.
Chinese coffee puts me at peace.
Oh, please. I had a cup of Java there once. Did anything but put me at peace. My stomach did flip-flops for days.
You had to be in a border area. What street were you on?
Street? What? Who knows? Chinatown, acid.
You must have been in a border area.
I wasn't reading maps. All I know is I could have opened a drain with the stuff.
That's the point. If the coffee had acid, you couldn't have been in Chinatown. You were obviously in a border area. A couple of Chinese just sitting around the joint. Greeks running it.
So you know that for a fact?
Yes.
How?
Because the Chinese worship their stomachs and everything they put in them, so when it comes to coffee, it's the freshest.
Oh, I get it. They grind it from the bean.
Now, that's pretentious. Only they use the very best bean. And it's brewed fresh in Silex pots only. Glass, never an urn. And do you know the final touch?
Soy sauce.
Cream. Real cream. Some places, not many, half and half. That's as far as they'll descend. But most places, cream. Throw the whole quart at you. Wouldn't that give you a lift?
No. For me, the Chinese are not escapist entertainment. They're crammed into sweatshops
and obscure poverty.
They should be glum and depressed. It depresses the hell out of me that they're not.
They have hope. They inspire me. I admire them, really.
You do not. You feel superior to them. Isn't that it? No matter how broke you are?
Nonsense. I like their spirit.
Please.
When you look at his legacy, his career, his work ethic, what lessons do you think the younger generations of actors can take from his career?
Well, there's something to be said first and foremost about his professionalism, okay, just about everyone I interviewed for the book and everyone I spoke to about Jerry had nothing but good to say about him, and there's a reason for that. He made friends wherever he went, and it's important to build for an actor to or someone who's going into the field of entertainment to build a good reputation for themselves by being a good friend, by being a good colleague. I'm thinking of the things that he did, for example, when a guest player would arrive on the set of Law and Order, you know, pouring a glass of juice for them for a dry throat or something like that. Getting people to relax and feel at ease at home. He was very good at that, putting people at ease. And I noticed it right away when I did the interview with him. It was like talking to your next door neighbor, you know, and it was that kind of thing. So he had this way of putting people at ease. And the other thing was he had a great feeling, a great appreciation for his fans. Peter Murkison tells a story about being out one day for lunch with Jerry and Benjamin Bratt, and fans kept coming up to the table asking for Jerry's autograph, and he, you know, he went along with that. He spoke with them and chatted with them and so forth. And at one point, Peter Murkison said to him, "Jerry, your lunch is getting cold." And he said, "Yeah, kid, but you know, these are the people that keep us in business. They're the reason why we're doing what we're doing." So he really had a profound respect for people, and you know, on the talent side, in terms of his contribution to, say, you know, American acting or film or, you know, theater, television, whatever, he was a natural. He had this. He came through as real, as tangible. That's why the NYPD, the police officers and so forth were so fond of him, because you know, they would tell him, "Jerry, you really got it. You know what our life is like, and you portray it as it is, with no gloss or anything. It is what it is." And to be able to do that with such class and ease, I think that's what makes him a standout in terms of you know, the legacy that he leaves behind.